Welcome to episode 4 of Parallel Lines. Thanks for joining us again, and this time we're opening the podcast with a bit of live footage from Manchester Piccadilly Railway Station, where I am partaking in the Railway Children charity sleepout event.
And I am here, honest. I'm here taking photographs of them sleeping. All the little children, we're just trying to get, well, they're railway staff and colleagues and friends and people who've got connections to the rail industry in some way. And they're all about to go to sleep on this busy concourse. But it's quite a thing, isn't it, that the people coming together is the thing we were talking about, the sort of railway family coming together to do something a bit different.
It is. Tony's not going to stay awake with me all night or try and sleep on the cold floor of the railway station, but he is here to support it for a little while. And it's a great event, a great charity, actually. I've done a number of events with Railway Children over the years, and it's a real family vibe. It covers participation from the whole supply chain that's involved in rail, from the people at the public facing end with the train operating companies and the likes of Network Rail, to here tonight we've got people from the rolling stock kind of end of things and the supply chain involved in providing labour, you know, out and about on the railway. So a real mix, actually. It's railway family vibes. I'm loving it.
And we're seeing the railway sort of doing its thing before it goes to bed at the same time, aren't we, here at the station. They're gradually closing it down and telling passengers to clear off from various bits so they can close them for the night, which is an interesting thing, because most people who travel by train do it in reasonably well in the daytime, and seeing these last people rushing for their last train home, and there's still staff on duty. Oh, look,
hey!
Somebody's just won a card game. But there's a lot of staff still at work, aren't there, which we forget sometimes.
It's really interesting in any part of the railway system, seeing how things go to bed for the night, and whether that's a station, you know, a depot, a train crew depot where people are sort of turning up for their night shift or going home after their last shift. I always find it fascinating, all the bits about the railway waking up or going to sleep. And if I could just describe the scene where I am just now, stood underneath the big departures board at Manchester Piccadilly, which has, I'm going to try and count now, which is always a bit of pressure. It's got six screens that normally show all the different destinations that you can get a train to in the next sort of, you know, hour or so. And that's now got three blank screens, and only three of them have got writing on them, because all of the trains are sort of reducing in number, and actually quite a few of them now aren't even trains anymore, they're buses, which is causing more confusion than I realised it would do to the travelling public, who are sort of a bit bemused by a screen that says bus at a railway station. So that's what we can see now, is just how few trains are kind of around at this time of night.
And the staff are here cleaning the station. There are people, this is what we forget, there are people overnight working on the railway, whether they are cleaning the trains, maintaining the trains, maintaining the stations, cleaning the stations. There's a new waiting room going to be built here, and the contractors are just arriving with their kit to start working overnight, doing work on that. That's what goes on behind the scenes, and we're incredibly grateful for people who are prepared to work shifts like this, because some of us just aren't up to it.
And the railway relies on that. There's the daytime railway that is what most passengers see, and then that all kind of goes to bed, and a whole different railway wakes up and comes to life at night. And whether that's, you know, more freight trains operating during the night, or whether that's a train care depot doing all of its work overnight, all of its big jobs overnight, looking after cleaning and maintaining the trains, or whether that's, like you say, improvement work, whether that's building a new waiting room or whether that's doing engineering work on the railway, that all happens at night when we're all, you know, away from it, tucked up in our beds. So being here tonight's amazing, seeing things winding down and ramping up.
And a few people coming through who are used to travelling late at night by train, not used to seeing sort of 50 or 60 people bedding down in sleeping bags on the station either, which is causing some interesting discussions.
We have been asked if we're part of some sort of protest movement, which come a few hours' time, perhaps we'll think of something to protest about, but at the moment that's not our intention.
Right, now look at me. Don't look around. No, look at me. Do you know what the last depart... Don't you? You nearly looked up at the board then. She tried to cheat. I'm going to see if Anna Jane knows what the last departure is from here. Where do you think the last train goes to from here? You've been staring at that board. We've been here a couple of hours already.
Well, it's alphabetical, isn't it, that board? So
but I can see what I can see
the
what the
last departure.
Yeah, what's the last departure?
The airport, I'm going to say.
Very good. Yes. So the last departure is a train.
I was going to say Wilmslow if it was alphabetical, but yeah, the airport, of course.
So
which is an interesting attention that we have on the railway around serving places like airports, which of course have a pretty much 24-hour, 7-day-a-week desire for trains to call there, versus things like access to undertake maintenance work and engineering work. So Manchester Airport is a really good example of that, where, you know, every few weeks they need to run a bus because they can't run a train, because you've got to get in there at some point to do the maintenance. And actually, as much as we'd like to run trains there all the time, all day, all night of every day of the week, you know, we've got to do that trade-off every now and then to do the work that is essential to keep the railway running.
So what are we going to talk about tonight? Now we're standing here watching everyone else go to bed.
Yeah, well, we thought, based on the success of our last slightly controversial session about drivers, we'd test the water on another slightly controversial topic, which is really about, and I'm going to broaden it out, it's not as narrow as to talk about who owns the railway in maybe the more traditional sense of nationalised versus privatised that we hear a lot about in the press. We're going to talk a little bit about that, but also more broadly about who runs which bits and how might you deliver what we need to deliver on the railway. How is it done elsewhere? How do we do it in the UK? What works, what doesn't? So it's all about who does what and who owns what, Tony. How about that?
So tell me, is everything that's going on in the country at the moment that's to do with the railways really owned by a load of foreigners?
That is another myth-buster for us to do, Tony. You know I love a bit of myth-busting. No, it isn't. But the press would like you to believe it is sometimes, and certain other people would like you to believe it is sometimes. It's true to say that there are a lot of companies that are not UK-based who have invested in what is delivered in the UK, or who are responsible for delivering some of what's part of our system. It's not true to say that the railway is run by a load of foreign companies. That is not the case.
So are we subsidising all the people who travel all over Europe because they're extracting vast amounts of money from our railways, or have they been?
So this is often mentioned, isn't it? Or it has often been mentioned over the years. And there is some truth in that, I suppose, insofar as we have had variously Dutch and German, for instance, railways, the companies that run the railways in those countries invested in our operations. But I think to say that we have subsidised their railway systems through that model is certainly to oversimplify, and I think is not really the case. You know, we have had a privatised railway for the past 30 so years, and that has involved money from all over the world and companies from all over the world, including UK companies, but also far-flung destinations like Japan and all over the place. Generally speaking, I think we've benefited from the knowledge, the expertise, and frankly the money from those countries more than we've subsidised other countries.
One of the other myths is about the amount of money that's flowed out, because some of those companies that tried to invest in the UK ended up getting it wrong and had to pump money in. And we know, for instance, that the Dutch, when they owned the ScotRail franchise, put more money in than they took out of it all the way through. And several of those overseas companies have now sold up and gone because it wasn't making them the vast amounts of money they thought it would. So it's not been that sort of let's hoover up vast amounts of cash from the UK and make our travel cheap as a simple thing like that, has it?
No, I don't think it has been. And I think more than anything, what tends to happen is it becomes less of a factual debate and more of a philosophical one, if I can put it like that. So some people will just fundamentally disagree with foreign companies being involved in the delivery of our railway, and that's fine. You can have your point of view. But what I would probably say is that it's an opinion more than a view that's based in fact, if we really drill down into what's delivered by those companies. And then you get into the murky kind of depths of we could unravel our pensions and how many of those companies are actually, you know, delivering profits to the benefit of our pensions. And that really is, again, getting into territory that I am just not an expert in, Tony. So maybe let's leave it at that level of detail.
So let's move on a little bit. We know that right across Europe, private companies are getting involved in running passenger trains. It's not a uniquely British thing. There are private operators right across Europe. Perhaps one of the differences is that what happened here was the government asked some of the private operators to give them large amounts of money for the privilege of running trains, and that's not been the way that privatisation has happened in little bits in Europe, has it? And that's been one of the more difficult things that's caused a lot of problems, because companies have not just been asked to run trains as a private company, but to give big sackfuls of cash to the government for the privilege of doing it.
Yeah, so I think what it's probably important to highlight here is that the UK rail industry is not unique in being privatised, and that's been the case for decades in pretty much all of Western Europe. The model, however, is different, and the model that the UK government of the day and subsequent governments have chosen to deploy to the end of privatising the railway is different to how they've chosen to do it in Europe, and that brings with it a different approach to things like subsidy. So developing a franchise, as was, and responding to the opportunity to operate a franchise the way that it has historically been done in the UK has involved the companies needing to put a lot of money in, actually, because that's the exam question that they were asked. And so companies, rational economic operators, will respond to the market, and they will respond to the exam question, if you like, that's set to them. And fundamentally, the exam question asked of UK train operating companies was different to that which was asked of their European operating counterparts. The rewards were big. The potential rewards on offer were very big, particularly at the start of franchising in sort of the 90s and the early 2000s. But the risks were big too. And what we saw with players like on the East Coast operation with National Express and others was that actually the risks were realised. And that has led to players in our UK rail industry leaving the market. It will be really interesting to see what happens with the new kind of era of contracts, but something is going to come out of the next round of contracts being let, and it will not be as franchises were before. What will those risk and reward margins be? We don't know yet, and we don't know who's going to be interested. Will it be the same players? Will it be new players? Will it be new combinations of old players teaming up together? We've just seen Alstom, for instance, being announced as running. They're going to be part of running the new open access operator, Wrexham and Shropshire. That's a new development that's interesting, isn't it, Tony?
Yes, and they have been doing that elsewhere in the world. So it's not like they're dipping the toe in the water here. They're building on something they've tried elsewhere and saying, we think we can make it work in the UK as well. So that's another of those bringing bits of expertise in that we were talking about before.
And they must have seen something, mustn't they, that they think they fancy the look of. So we'll see what else anybody fancies the look of when more detail comes out about new contracts and opportunities. But the good news story, and we should always come back to this, the good news story is that people have always been interested in it. They've always fancied it. And we want that. We want people to fancy being involved in UK Rail, because the worst case scenario would be if the market, in its broadest sense, the international market of players who could potentially own and operate railways, if they all took a look at UK Rail and said, oh, we don't like the look of that, it's too risky, or, you know, we don't want to be associated with it because it's toxic, or, you know, any of those bad news stories you could have, that would be the worst thing for our industry.
I'm going to ask you a question, and you can choose whether to answer it or not, but with your expertise and your experience within the industry, do you think now we've gone too far in the way things have been fragmented? Could we recreate British Rail as it existed at the end of the 1990s?
I'm not averse to us returning to a nationally owned and operated UK rail system, but I don't think it's possible, not because of a lack of will or ability to join back together certain areas of the industry, but I think there are some fundamental building blocks of the system that it would be practically and economically impossible to bring back into national ownership. So for example, there are some really, really expensive and complex bits, principally around rolling stock and that kind of thing, where I personally, and you know, I'm not an expert in everything, I know you like to flatter me, Tony, and say that I know about everything, I definitely don't know the detail of everything, and I personally, from what I can see, can't envisage a way that we could afford to do that as a country. I just think that would be massively expensive. It would be massively destabilising to the market. There's a lot of, you know, things that are linked to things like pensions and investment markets that I think it would disrupt too dangerously for any government of whatever colour to consider that to be the right thing to do. But I do think there's benefit, and we probably will head this way if what's to be believed about general elections and things proves to be true. I think there's a lot that we could benefit from bringing a lot closer together and bringing under common operation, potentially common ownership where it's possible. I just can't see us doing it for absolutely everything.
And on that theme, one of the things that I see quite often in the comments underneath stories on the news, you should never read the underlying comments, and I've told mayors and people this, never read the comments because they're so crazy. But I saw one the other day, because some new trains aren't performing brilliantly immediately from delivery, even though that's something that goes back to British Rail days, they say, well, we should return to having a British train manufacturing industry again. And they're the same people that also say we should be building all our own cars and stuff. Some things are kind of a lot more global now because that's just the way things are. So whether it's signals or trains or electrification equipment or quite a lot of other things, we can't go it alone and have our own private little railway anymore, can we?
No, and I think it's really hard to turn back the tide on things like that. The world has changed, you know, and that just is a fact, and trying to turn that round would, you know, almost certainly cause more disruption and cost than it would benefit. I mean, the crazy example I heard today, nothing to do with railways, I'll mention this, was I was listening to the radio and Mariella Fostrup was mentioning an example of Mulberry handbags, which used to be a really high quality, really expensive product made in the UK, and you know, you could really trust the product as being, you'll spend a lot of money on it but it'll last forever because it's really well manufactured. They offshored their manufacturing process. I don't even know where it's made, but let's say somewhere in Asia, so the other side of the world, some years ago now. And the perception now is it's still a really expensive product, but it isn't the same quality. But that's how manufacturing's gone. That's how, you know, capitalism works. That's how global markets and global production works. The railway in many ways is no different to that. And so to try and go it alone and turn that tide around, I think, you know, you could, but would it be the right thing to do? And would it actually get you the results that you want? Would it last for the long term because of, you know, the costs involved and all the rest of it? I don't think so. And I can't see it happening.
I remember all those people back in the 1970s and 80s particularly who were proudly buying their British Leyland cars, not realising that the diesel engine was a Peugeot and the gearbox was a VW. But that, you know,
yeah, and that was in the 70s, yeah.
And we're looking at trains over in front of us there, that one was assembled in the UK, but it's got bits that were made in the UK, bits that were made in all over Europe.
Yep.
So that's just the way it works, isn't it?
Yeah, and as I said earlier on, I think generally at a global, different use of global, at a high level, I think we've generally benefited from that approach more than we've disbenefited. For all the problems we've got in the industry and for all the challenges we've had, I think generally speaking, the collective knowledge, experience, investment of a global market has been to our benefit, not to our disbenefit.
One of the things that's always good for anything, and particularly transport and infrastructure to do with transport, is a long-term plan. So one of the things that we maybe have struggled with, because our governments think in five-year chunks particularly, is the long-term plan. But the interesting thing is recently that we're seeing across Europe that even their governments have lost their long-term plan for things like their railways. So we know German Railways is in really serious trouble because it's lost its way because it didn't have a long-term plan. A few years ago, French railways were in serious trouble because the infrastructure was collapsing. There were two major accidents in France because they took their eye off the ball to save money. It's not a uniquely British thing that we're losing our way, but there are lessons coming from Europe that tell us all that we must keep thinking long-term, and that's a hard thing for politicians, isn't it?
It is, and it's so important, the point you make, Tony, that long-term planning is so important for something like the railway. Not least of all because the assets involved and the really expensive assets that are involved have to have a really long payback time. So, you know, the life of a train, you know, is arguably supposed to be 30 years or around that. But what did we see with, you know, with the likes of Pacers? You know, they can last longer than that if you choose to eke out their life longer. And that applies to, you know, fixed assets out on the infrastructure as well. They have really long payback times. So to limit yourself in the way that politicians inevitably do to five-year funding cycles is really limiting for how we plan and invest in the railway. And I think that's why it is so problematic that railways unfortunately become such a political football, because inevitably that limits the thinking of the decision makers when actually, you need to take the politics out of it and think about what's the right thing to do for the system, for the assets, you know, let's face it, for the people involved in delivering the railway. We need to think longer term. So the best thing that could come out of, you know, of any of the changes that we've got coming ahead of us with politics, with GBR and all the rest of it, is if we could move towards a longer term way of thinking. It's the best possible thing that could come out of it for me.
Do you think there might even be a case for saying to the train operators, instead of us worrying about the money quite so much, how about seeing how many people we can get to travel by train? Because, you know, the numbers that come up are that a lot of seats and a lot of trains spend a lot of time not carrying people. So would there be an interesting challenge to the industry to say, how many people do you reckon we could get on the train if we sold it differently, or sold it at the right price, or were prepared to take a gamble on fares being different or something?
It's an interesting question you pose, Tony. I'm not sure how it would work practically, because whilst I have seen a lot of fresh air being carried around recently, and I've spoken to you about this, I've spent a lot of time on trains with hardly anybody on them in certain parts of the country. I do also know that we already have very busy trains, and trains that some people would already class as, inverted commas, overcrowded, even in this post-COVID recovery sort of timescale that we still class ourselves as being in. So I like the idea, but the practicality of doing that in a way that doesn't have unintended consequences of suddenly overcrowding trains when you don't want them to be overcrowded would be interesting. And I think you might need some societal shifts, some further societal shifts on top of the ones we've already seen around, you know, the obsession with 9 to 5 probably needs to be diluted, you know, Monday to Friday, and the way our models and our thinking in the railway is built around, you know, peak off peak days, weekdays versus weekends. But I like the thinking.
And this is the other bit of the big debate that's going on now, and we're seeing people trying it, where you do sell each seat on the train rather than selling tickets that you can get on any train that comes. You know, if you go onto the continent of Europe, several of the countries, particularly on their long distance services, your ticket is only valid for one train, and that's the way it works.
Yeah.
We've had this sort of pride that you could buy a ticket that gets you onto any train that comes, or any group of trains that come, and that maybe also isn't sustainable or it's got to change in some way if we're going to try and get people to use those empty trains, or we're going to control things so we haven't got 300 people crammed in standing in a train all the way from London to Manchester after a football match. There's a whole big pile of questions to answer.
There is, and I remember working with some of our European colleagues on a project a few years ago, and when they first started working with us, they were horrified that we didn't have reservation-only long-distance trains in the UK. But we don't, and we certainly didn't pre-pandemic. We sort of, I suppose, we experimented a bit with it during the pandemic for social distance purposes, and some of that has continued in a way afterwards. But I think the fundamental behavioural shift that's needed for users of UK Rail is massive, because people just don't behave that way. We're so accustomed to turn up and go behaviours, ticketing, and, you know, that's the expectation at the minute. I think we could choose to move away from that and have more of a reservations-based system, and maybe that is where we'll go, but we're not there yet. There's some huge changes that will be needed.
One of the other questions that comes up quite a bit is how much is done in-house by companies and how much is outsourced, and whether that's to do with catering, maintaining trains, cleaning, building things, everything. There's that decision to make between, do we do it ourselves and use our own team, or do we outsource? And I can say I go to Ireland regularly, and Irish Rail still insource. Is that the word? They still do a lot of stuff in-house.
Integrate.
They do a lot of stuff in-house, maintaining trains. They've found ways of making parts themselves that are certainly massively cheaper than buying them from the original manufacturer. Massively, massively cheaper. And so they have a certain conviction that a certain amount of their work will stay in-house because they've proved it's cost effective. But that's a small railway with limited fleets and limited operations. But it's a big decision. It's not just as simple as saying, well, that will save us money if we do it that way.
Yeah, and I think the decision becomes part of the thing that stops you doing it another way, if that makes sense. So it's, in some ways, I think it's not that one is right and one is wrong. And, you know, people spend a lot of time studying this in their business degree, or, you know, their MBA, you know, talking about vertical integration versus outsourcing of all sorts of your supply chain as a business. So you can debate it all day long, and it works both ways for different reasons. But I think if we talk about railway supply chains, often it stays the way it is because the change of bringing it in-house or the change of outsourcing it becomes the thing that is difficult to do and costly to do. So actually, if it's already in-house, then it might well stay in-house because you need a fundamental change to do it differently, and that works vice versa. What I think we're different in the railway at doing is you don't necessarily know when something's outsourced. So it's hidden sometimes.
Yeah, well, I was just looking at, well, most of the trains have disappeared from behind us now, but a moment ago there was a train that was maintained in-house and there was a train that's maintained outsourced by the a maintaining company. There was another one that's manufactured and maintained by the same company as part of the single contract, all in a row there. They all deliver about the same reliability, mm-hmm. and I see the numbers, but for different reasons the different contracts have been let. And when we've got some interesting discussions going on, haven't we, that trains, for example, that are on contracts where the manufacturer agrees to maintain them and promises to deliver so many a day in working order, but actually we're finding they're quite happy to take the fines for not delivering enough. And that's down to how you write the contract, I suppose, isn't it? And it's down to them understanding that actually, as one managing director said to me, I can't carry my passengers on pound notes. I actually want the trains, not the compensation. So it's getting all the contracts right, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, which comes down often to incentives and how you incentivise different behaviours. Some of what you just described there is big money stuff, you know, and that's important. There's some kind of, if you like, smaller money stuff that I think is quite well disguised on the railway. If we think about something that passengers see all the time in the form of on-train catering and cleaning, I don't think passengers necessarily notice a lot of the time whether something is provided in-house or outsourced. And that's, I think, an example of where train operating companies do it quite well, actually, because they bring, where it is outsourced, they do a very good job of bringing those companies into their kind of family, if you like. You know, they wear the same uniform, they get a lot of the same customer service training, they're, you know, operating to the same standard as their own employees. So from a passenger perspective, from a customer experience point of view, it's relatively seamless and as though it is in-house. And I think that's a good example of where you can realise some of the kind of pounds and pence savings of an outsource model without it being to the detriment of the product that you're trying to offer to the customer.
So another bit of sort of random conversation, but with a point, and we welcome your feedback on it. Behind us, everybody's starting to go to sleep now because it's getting late. The beeping you've heard is the man who's going to drive the cleaning machine round and drive everyone beeping mad for the next couple of hours, because he's very proudly cleaning Piccadilly Station. And it's important that he does, because we're proud of our stations. But behind us, there's the railway family in all its different forms, which is one of the things that we are quite proud of at the end of the day. And I talk to senior people and people who I was going to say the chalk face, I don't know what it is in railway terms, but the equivalent. And actually you see them together quite often, and because we're with railway children today, I remember being on the Three Peaks and, you know, seeing a train driver assisting his managing director over a particularly difficult bit of a climb up a mountain, and at that point they were just two people and they were chatting quite happily about some football, probably.
Yeah.
But the family is still full of people. There are tensions, and some of them are driven by external forces, but this is still the railway family that does things together.
You know what? It's what's kept me in the railway for, you know, as long as I have been, and the reason I'll probably always work on the railway, because the family aspect of what we do is huge. That there are all those contractual boundaries, there are all those misaligned incentives and different objectives that we often talk about, but at the end of the day, I've met very few people who work on the railway who don't just fundamentally want to deliver a good railway and come to work every day to do that, and all those boundaries are just generally not a thing. It's all about delivering for the better of the railway, and tonight is a jolly good example of that. Railway family together raising money for a really good cause, and really proud to be here, Tony. You're going to let me get some kip now?
Last time you threw it at me to remember the contact email address, and I couldn't remember it, and it took three takes. So take one. Anna Jane, can you remember the email address for people to get back in touch with us?
It is contact@pllines.com. That's contact@pllines.com.
I'm going to let you get some kip, and I notice they're turning the lights down a little bit. It's almost like they want to help people just get off. The next episode, wherever it is, episode 5, will be something completely different again, but we welcome your feedback. Continue to send us thoughts and ideas.
We might have just scratched the surface of a few things in this discussion today, so if you want us again to find out more and actually get somebody who knows about stuff to talk to us as well, we will do that.
Thanks for listening. Once again, I'm going to go and get in my sleeping bag now.